You are listening to Conversations with Columbiana County, the podcast about all things Columbiana County.
Thank you for listening to our two-part interview with Columbiana County Health Commissioner Wes Vins. In this, the second part of our discussion, we will talk with Wes about the coronavirus pandemic, especially the local response. For more information about Wes and the health district more generally, please make sure to listen to part one of the interview. Columbiana County General Health District, and then March of 2019 happens. No, 2020 happens, excuse
2020.
Me. You know, we're all losing a year, and especially you guys, I'm sure. You probably thought. So March of 2020 happens, and I'm sure you had to shuffle people around and just make things work. Hopefully you're getting back to normal, but can you tell us a little bit about what that response was like and how you marshaled forces and what happened?
Sure. So we started to watch that, watch the spread of the virus, I would say around Christmas, New Year's of 2019 into 2020.
See, not just me. Thank you.
Yeah. I forget how old I am sometimes. And so we started to watch that virus. We started to look at our plans and say, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? And so we started to move through essentially mental exercises with our leadership team while we're keeping our eye on the horizon, so to speak. So we were preparing, I would say in the Navy, we're moving to battle stations. We had a plan on who was gonna do what, who was gonna be assigned to what turret, who was gonna be assigned to what. We even had plans in place that we further evolved through the month of February to, as we saw the virus move and grow across the country. So we had the luxury, let me say this, Ted. We had the luxury to learn from afar, from places like Washington when they had the nursing home outbreak. We learned from California. We learned a lot from New York City. We learned even more as it got closer and closer. So Columbiana County was late to the party. That's okay. I'm okay with being last. But what we did was we learned and watched. I listened to, quite honestly, pleads from other health commissioners from other places in the country, saying, you have no idea, this thing spreads through your office like wildfire on pieces of paper. This thing will get in your office and you'll have half your staff out in 3 days. We heard that from other health departments. And so we started to take our, as you hear those personal pleads from these people in the trenches that are fighting this virus at levels that we couldn't even comprehend, we started to gear ourselves up. So we go back to our plan.
Can I interrupt you a second?
Sure.
And if you're okay with this,
yeah,
I'd like to interrupt you every now and then with some questions about COVID that we heard about as we were going through it. And because of the kind of the crunch of time and the fact that the science wasn't there, you know, specifically, because it's a novel coronavirus.
Correct.
We didn't know with 100% certainty whether certain advice being given was 100% accurate or not. It was probably done in an abundance of caution, some of the things. And we still don't know because we haven't had clarity of time. But I'm going to ask you a few things as we roll through with that caveat in mind. So you mentioned that people were talking about COVID spreading through the office on pieces of paper. I heard a horror story in China of somebody who had been, you know, completely isolated except for going one time to her elevator and touching the elevator button and being infected that way. But then I also heard reports that really surface contamination was not a major problem. Of course, it's always a great idea to wash your hands thoroughly for 30 seconds with warm water and all that sort of thing, but it was more often an airborne transmission. So can you talk a little bit about what we think we know now about surface transmission versus aerosol transmission?
Sure. Yeah. Surface transmission is not nearly as predominant as we initially thought, but anything is better than nothing. And so early on, we didn't have a lot of tools. We had no vaccine. We didn't understand what we were dealing with. So if you clean everything, right, let's start there. Let's start doing that. And so I think because that was one of the interventions that we had, I think a lot of people faulted to that and said, since that was our focus, we said, oh, well, that must have been where I got the virus. That's how I was infected. And we didn't know. And so in some regards, and this is some of my colleagues have talked about, we had science that was behind the ball. We already had infections. We had communities. We had nursing home outbreaks, and we didn't know what we were dealing with because the science was lagging. We had the luxury, again, here in Columbiana County to say, okay, we know we're going to get a 50% infection rate in an institution based on the nursing home. We knew based on, this is Washington, right? So we knew what our infection rates were going to happen. And so when we started to see positives at the Elkton prison, you can imagine my alarm, right? Because I was anticipating, I knew the pod structures out there, the open environment that they had. And if we had nursing homes that we were seeing a 50% infection rate, and we know we have 2,400 inmates at the federal prison, what am I going to do with 1,200 infected positives? And then if you translate that into how many turn into hospitalizations and then how many deaths you're going to have, oh my gosh, you can see my alarm. And fortunately, you know, we had a lot of, again, good partners that helped us accomplish that. But other than the nursing home data that came out of the state of Washington, we almost had nothing to go on to anticipate what might happen at the federal prison when we had some positives out there. And then we ended up with a few fatalities and at the federal prison. And, you know, things can escalate very fast. And so that was a real challenge for us. So I think when you look at our experience, we did have a bit of a luxury here locally in Columbiana County. And so during that time, before we saw a positive, if you recall, we even did a press conference with the county commissioner's office at the EMA, and State Representative Tim Ginter was also present, along with our hospital partners, to, I think, reassure and make sure that the community knew where we were and that we weren't sitting on our hands, that we have done everything that we can to prepare for this. We've already had our conversations. We've got our planning in place. But as the virus cases evolved and we started to see more activity across the country, that made us look at our own plans. And so not only do we have a plan that says this is how we're going to handle it, we started to develop plans. This is how we're going to grow. This is our maximum capacity. This is what we have the capacity. And I'm talking about adding phone lines, buying computers, looking at staff and saying, okay, what's your skill set? So we were preparing at that moment to demobilize every other service in our agency and target on COVID-19 cases. And I said it from the very beginning, the most important thing, and this is my history coming through and my training at Mahoning County and my education at YSU and so on and so forth, the most important thing we can do is track the virus. We've got to get to the positives as soon as possible and identify all of their contacts. That's what's going to prevent someone from going to the grocery store, going to church, to further spread the virus. The sooner you can get it to at the center, the more effective, the center of the bullseye. The sooner we can do that, the better off we are. And so we committed at the very beginning of this pandemic, before we even had a positive, that was our priority. And we were successful with that, Ted. We investigated every single case, most cases within 24 hours. And I have to tell you, that wasn't Wes. That was not Wes Vins. That was the staff at the Columbiana County Health District. They were committed to this before we even started. And we're talking about people that, oh yeah, well, the epidemiologist, right? And public health nurses. Well, but now we're starting to talk about the vaccine nurse and the BCMH nurse and the emergency preparedness coordinator. And believe it or not, food inspectors, clerical staff from the environmental division, you know, our public information officer on the phone with patients, and contacts of patients to make sure we got to everybody. It was around the clock. It was 24/7. And I say that in actuality, it was 24/7. We had people working in the middle of the night. We had people working all day Saturdays, all day Sundays. It was perpetual. It was continuous. And it's amazing to see people work that hard out of their own internal drive. They were trying to do their very best. And I'm so proud of them for that.
So obviously you had great response from your staff, it sounds
yes. Like,
were people more and more away from their penumbra of skill set, normal skill set, mm-hmm. allowed themselves to be drafted into this kind of this contact tracing
Volunteer, Ted.
Process, volunteer. Yes. So that's a great response. What was the response to the public then when the contact tracers tried to do their job?
Excellent. Excellent. Like I said at the beginning, the residents of our county have full understanding of their responsibility to the bigger picture, to their community, to their neighbors, to their school, to their to where they work, their business. And this goes both ways. This goes to the employer as well, where the employer says, no, go ahead and stay. We need you to stay home. I can't have you infecting the rest of our team. Employers went to great lengths to try to come up with tools and mechanisms to help keep their staff safe and still stay in business. Our businesses did a fantastic job. They would send us plans because that's what they'd say, what do you want us to do? What are we supposed to do? I say, well, here's some ideas, and this is our staff. You know, our public information, Laura Faust, handled a lot of that. Our environmental division staff handled a lot of that, to where they would guide the environmental or the physical side of a business to put up plexiglass, cleaners. Well, what cleaners do I get? Well, here, let me send you a link to the CDC of what your cleaner you should use. Well, what procedure should I use? Well, here's an example. Here's a template. Come up with a plan in your own office, and then you send it to us. We'll critique it. We'll make comments and send it back to you. We had so many businesses did that, and so we were able to help guide them so that they could stay fully operational and keep, again, economy, health, education. We did the exact same thing when it was time to go back to school. So in the spring, when the schools closed at the state order, not a local health order, I want to point that out, Tad. We did not close schools. As far as I know, our agency has never closed a school. We do it in partnership with our schools. Health and education in this county are so connected. Again, so impressed with our superintendents and our school boards and the staff at the schools. Doing what they needed to do to keep kids in school and keep the education piece moving. And so we did the same thing for the schools through the summer. We met with the schools all summer. So when it came time to go back to school in the fall, we had plans in place. We had educated nurses. We had staff. We had giant boards so that the staff, the clerical staff at the school, the nurse at the school, knew what to do with the child that was symptomatic or what to do with the child that was positive or a staff member that was positive. We had a big flow chart, so we printed, I don't know, 115 of these foam boards that we gave to every school. So every front counter and every nurse, every principal, every superintendent had these big boards so they could follow through when they talked to a concerned family. And so because of those plans and that partnership between the private sector and the schools, with our staff, we were able to stay as operational as possible.
Speaking of staying operational, and we've talked a little bit about you had the benefit of foresight because of other parts of the world and country who had to go through this before we did. And sometimes it was difficult to tease out from the news, you know, whether you're listening to local news, which I didn't think had the best coverage of COVID-19, I don't think, from a statistical standpoint. And there's an issue I want to get into you with on that as well. But if you look at the national news, of course, the larger urban areas, when first it happens in Seattle, and then New York City, then I think West Texas. But so you got a feel for when things seem bad in the country and the arc of the disease progression there. But let's talk about in Columbiana County, what was the actual experience for you? What was the arc of the disease in Columbiana County? When did we really start to see the effect? What were some of the big kind of specific instances of outbreaks, and when did it begin to decline?
Sure. So I would say the most impactful was certainly our first case, as well as our first death. Those two pieces made it real. It stopped being on the evening news going on in New York or Texas or Seattle, and it started to be happening here. It became real. And there were some folks that still were a bit distant from it until they knew somebody, until it was somebody at work or at church that became positive. And again, we didn't have a lot of antivirals at that time. You know, we had very limited ventilators in the country. Our hospital systems didn't have a lot of tools. Because we didn't understand the virus medically. We didn't understand what was the best treatment for individuals that we see today, right? We've learned so much with things like remdesivir and these cocktails that they put together to help address all the different pieces. So survivability, because of the advances, the quick advances in the adaptation of the medical industry. But I'll say this, locally, very impressed. Anita Hackstead, president of Salem Hospital, on top of it. Dr. Gretchen Nickel, chief medical officer, East Liverpool City Hospital. She was asking for remdesivir when there was only a handful of doses in the state of Ohio. She's on the phone. She wanted that here. Well, I think their interest of providing that top-level medical care, they stayed on top of the medical side. And so we're on conference calls, obviously, with them every week, sometimes multiple times a week on the cell phones, right? Those are the middle of the night calls. I'm learning from them the medical side, probably at least as fast as I'm learning it from my state health department partners, because they're connected with the medical industry. And so they're helping me understand things the same as I'm helping them understand quarantine and isolation and some of these other tools that we're dealing with. And so there was this open dialogue, this constant, it was a constant open dialogue between my leadership team, our health partners in the field, the two city health departments that I talk to constantly, as well as the state health department. We were on the calls with the state health department probably twice a week anyway.
And the actual medical response, I think, evolved, if I remember correctly. I mean, at the beginning, they didn't even know. I think one of the first things they learned was that they had patients on their back on the ventilator, and then they learned that it was better to turn them over for breathing. And then you got the antivirals like the remdesivir. Mm-hmm. But that's the medical response. But there's, and so you're learning things there. And then on the public health messaging side, there's probably, and as a county health district, I don't suppose you're part of this policy decision making, but there's the issue of, is it best to have a total shutdown? Is it better to allow some movement? You know, I've seen various studies about if you have a total shutdown, you'll have the quote unquote cheaters that will go around and then they will cause the spread to occur. So I imagine public health administrators are learning as you go about that, right? And that probably informed the decision from the state and others that made those decisions about closing things down, reopening, when to do those things.
Yeah, a lot of those, I would say nearly all of those decisions were state-level policy decisions. And sometimes we would learn about those state policies. Though we were on a conference call with the governor every week. So every week, health commissioners, we had an hour, sometimes more, with the governor every week. I spoke to him myself personally several times. I spoke with Dr. Acton myself. I've talked with the general from the National Guard. So we had a very open dialogue, even during, you know, the Elkton outbreak. I spoke with, and we did conference calls every day, I think, for a week during the Elkton outbreak that included chief medical officers and CEOs from Summa Healthcare, Cleveland Clinic, University Hospital Systems, U.S. representatives, Congressman Bill Johnson. He was right there with us the whole time. He was on our calls every day. Bill was great, very responsive, along with, you know, our Tim Ginter. Also talked with him many, many times, sometimes late at night, in which he was trying to help bring, at the time, you recall, PPE, right? Face masks, face shields. I remember being, was putting my boys to bed, reading a book with my boys, and my phone rings. It's Representative Ginter. He's trying, it's 10:30 at night, 10 o'clock at night. He's trying to find us. He has a contact where he thinks he can help get us some supplies in Columbiana County that maybe we didn't have access to in another way. So again, back to that partnership, but, very demanding times, but the policies were set at the state level. And then we had to execute those and make them meaningful at the local level.
I apologize. I took you sidetracked again. But the Elkton prison was the single probably biggest outbreak and biggest problem for you in the county. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay. And so what month then would you say, either including that or excluding that, at what point was the outbreak the worst in Columbiana County?
Boy, and so it would be hard to measure this, Ted. I mean, we could obviously do it by deaths. We could measure this hard outbreak. We could measure that in cases, realizing we didn't have enough testing supplies early on. So we don't really know what our true numbers were early in the pandemic. We obviously had a large surge of case numbers in the Thanksgiving time, the November-December period. there were a lot of cases, but it didn't, it felt as though we understood what was happening. We had capacity. We were going through. We were doing our jobs.
There were more unknowns early on.
Early on.
Though the numbers weren't so high, you just didn't know what to expect if it happened, right?
March, April, and May, I think, were the most difficult for the health district. They were the most difficult for me, I think. And I think it was the most difficult time for our staff. You know, we were walking through a room with the lights out. And that's very, very difficult. And so there's a lot of energy at that time. But specifically, I think for our team and for our community, the probably the peak stress, the peak activity was around the time of the Elkin outbreak. And I'll tell you why. It's multifaceted.
And give us the time of that, because was that summer of?
No, that would have been in April.
Okay.
April and
pretty early
into May.
Pretty early.
Yeah, it was early. And I'll tell you it was multifaceted because one, we didn't have a lot of details. The science hadn't caught up with us yet. We had very little to go on as far as institutionalized outbreaks. We had a lot of positives very fast. And so we ended up with patients at both of our local hospitals, as well as hospitals further north of us. And so we had transportation concerns, and then we had capacity concerns at our local hospitals. And so as much as we want to care for an individual, we have to recognize that we have other individuals that may have other concerns too. So we have to be absolutely sure we don't overrun our hospitals so that we have capacity. And that's really when I learned the value of regionalized and state level partnerships. You know, we were able to, through all the partners I talked about, through Congressman Johnson's office, Representative Ginter, Dr. Acton, General Harris of the National Guard, the governor's office, we were able to mobilize some real support to reach out to our regional hospitals, in which we're on conference calls, and Cleveland Clinic and University Hospital SUMA, they're offering to send their fleet of ambulances to Columbiana County to help bail us out. It was huge. It was absolutely huge. It was amazing to see that huge network ready to back up little Columbiana County. And that week, Tad, where we had fatalities at the federal prison, sometimes one after another, and we had cases coming out of the prison system was sending two guards with every patient to the hospital. Each guard needed PPE. We didn't have it. The prison system had mandatory overtime, like the guards and the staff at the prison. And I talked with the warden, Mark Williams. I talked to him every day, sometimes multiple times a day. Their medical team, even their regional medical person, Dr. Minetti, Dr. Dunlap, are on the phone literally with the hospitals. And so what we ended up doing is we used those partnerships really to not just save lives in the federal prison system, but we also used that network to save lives, I think, here in Columbiana County, because we were able to rely on our partners outside to preserve our hospital systems.
That plus, I mean, you look at the federal prison as a closed environment, a closed population, but you can't forget that there are people going in and out of there to work every day.
Right.
So whether or not you want to think that's a closed environment, that opens it up to community spread.
Well, early in the process, because we were unsure of the spread of the virus within the prison system, again, testing supplies were very limited. The federal prison system was transporting an on-site testing. It was one of the very first on-site testing systems. It was an Abbott test system. They were actually getting that from the federal prison system. And so they were trying to identify who was positive. And so again, back to they were going with symptomatic. We really didn't know the extent of the spread of the virus within the prison system. And so back to your point about the workers, you know, the workers at that facility were quarantined. 300 of them quarantined because we were concerned about the spread of the virus coming out of the prison from work. Now they were allowed to go home and back to work. That was the extent. And that extended for a very, very long time at the prison. But I have to tell you that week, 10 days, 2 weeks, but there was a peak of a week in there in which from a health department position with all of the partners I just talked about and the intensity of where lives are at stake, you don't, the magnitude of what it is that you're doing really settles in on you.
Mm-hmm.
And at least it did on me. And I know it did on Dr. Amato, who was right with me the whole time as our medical director. We realized that, you know, things that we were doing had not been done before. There had never been a relay of patients in the state of Ohio that we were aware of at this magnitude for an outbreak. And so we were transporting inmates and patients across the region to allow for capacity at the local level. It was phenomenal. It was, there's a week, Tad, I didn't sleep.
And that was a week, I'm hearing you say, it was both the magnitude of what was happening and the fact that it was so new and you didn't know what to expect and you didn't have many of the things you needed to respond in large enough numbers, or whether it be the antivirals, that was a really tenuous time.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, the ventilator issue, you know, we were maximizing the use of the ventilators in the valley. So I'm talking about from Liverpool all the way north into Warren, because there were other people that were sick too. We have to remember there was a huge influx of positive cases and hospitalizations in the Youngstown region that were community
sure.
cases.
Mahoning County, Youngstown, they were ahead of the curve.
That's correct. They were
whereas Columbiana County was behind.
That's correct.
Mahoning County, both in cases and especially in deaths, were way ahead of the rest of the state of Ohio.
That's correct. And so here now we come to the situation with this institutional population in which we anticipate a 50% infection rate. And again, you do the math and you boil it down as to we don't have enough hospital beds. We've got to do something. So we were able to make that happen with our public health and our hospital partners.
One last question on the Elkton issue, and you touched on it briefly. You've talked about local and state partners, and you also did mention that the federal government or federal prison system provided the Abbott on-site testing. Since it is a federal prison, did you get support then from the federal government, anything other than that testing from the federal prison system?
Well, the federal prison system, they supported really the prison. So,
and that's what I'm referring to in your response at Elkton.
Yeah, absolutely. No,
yeah.
They didn't just leave that to us.
Yeah.
No, they brought in regional resources. They brought in additional guards. They were bringing in their own PPE that they could find in the prison system. They had the attention of the highest levels of the prison system because of the nature of the outbreak and the potential impact that it had. They have a full medical team there at the prison, but it didn't have the capacity to handle the volume that they were dealing with. And so in the end, what we ended up with, to really summarize the connection between the federal prison, public health, and the hospital systems across the region of Ohio, we set up the relay system, which was led by SUMA Healthcare System, Dr. Devney at SUMA in Akron. They set up a call center, so when the prison system had a patient that needed to be sent out, and that medical officer then would call the regional hub at SUMA. SUMA then would look at their spreadsheet to say, who in the region can take this patient? They would call. Now the prison's on the phone. The hub at SUMA would then call the different hospitals to coordinate care and then put the prison system on the phone with the ER at the hospital. So it was a warm handoff between the physician at the prison system to the actual physician that's going to receive that patient at the hospital. It increased response, it increased survivability, it increased capacity and capability at the hospital so that we didn't have two guards plus an inmate plugging up the emergency room. In some case, they had an alternate. They set up what they would call an alternate care center. And so they'd make sure that they had capacity, but that was regional, and it was all formulated at the hub at SUMA. And as far as I know, Tad, that is the only time that's ever been used in the state of Ohio.
Mm.
But what a huge learning experience for the hospital systems of Cleveland Clinic, University Hospitals. And again, early in the pandemic, they learned so much from that. And hopefully that model and what we learned from that will help in the future if we need to save lives during some other crisis in which the hospital system might be stressed.
The good news as we sit here today in June of 2021 is that so far during our conversation, we have talked about this in the past tense. Now, we know that's probably not entirely accurate. I think everybody in this room, I think, can talk about it fairly comfortably that way because we've all been fully immunized and as you said, the vaccine is highly effective. But are we safe to be talking about it in the past tense?
Well, we never know what the future has in store for us, Tad. I would say our future looks favorable. We're seeing case counts go in the right direction locally. Obviously, I'd like to see a higher vaccination rate. You know, at this point, we're seeing our vaccination rate in the mid-30%. Some communities are as high as 70 or 80%, which is really the goal.
So, Wes, am I understanding this, that the county is generally in the 30-something percent vaccination? And are there communities within Columbiana County that are at 75%, or are you talking about the state or the nation that are at 70-something percent?
Well, yeah, at Columbiana County, we're in the mid-30%, about 35% here vaccinated in Columbiana County. There are communities in the country. I don't have any specific data today with me to talk about each individual community here in Columbiana County, but across the country, 70-80% in some communities. So there's still room to go for increasing vaccination rates among Columbiana County residents, and the vaccine's readily available at, you know, 29 different partners here in the county.
So Columbiana County responded well, but isn't responding as well as we'd like to the vaccine option, whether it be compared to the country or the state, and the opportunities are out there.
That's right. Yeah, we'd certainly like to see an increase in vaccination rate, but different people view the vaccine in different ways. But you know, the vaccine is safe, Tad. We've seen it be very, very effective. I think you know, the state medical director recently referenced the COVID-19 vaccine as, quote, a dream vaccine because of its effectiveness relative to the other vaccines that we administer. Far more effective, we find, than the flu vaccine, seasonal flu vaccine, which is still very good. But we're also finding that the vaccine is effective against many of the strains that we see emerge here in recent times, including the UK strain and the Delta strain that we've seen emerge.
So far, no concerns specifically about these vaccines having an effect on those new strains.
That's correct.
Good. Is it true, though, that if we did not remain well vaccinated, that the longer this virus is allowed to infect and work through the population, the higher the chances are that it will mutate into something that would be outside of the effectiveness of these vaccines?
It could, as in any virus, could evolve. So the sooner that we can get it stamped out, the better. Much like many of the other viruses that we've been so successful in stamping out, and I'm going to use polio as an example, and, you know, smallpox. We don't even administer the smallpox vaccine really since the 1970s anymore. And so, you know, if we approach this correctly, and we continue with the vaccination effort, the isolation and the quarantine, we can really stop the spread of the virus, which is really the mission of public health since its onset, right? Prevent the spread of disease.
And you mentioned people have different thoughts about the vaccine. Mm-hmm. Do you want to get into that, about why they may have hesitancy?
Well, we have a lot of folks, you know, we get a lot of feedback on that. And so some folks feel that perhaps they don't need the vaccine. And we have to remind them that it's not just about them, right back to the community concept. This isn't just about vaccinating you. This is about stopping the spread of the virus in the community. So it's bigger than just you. We also have the safety, you know, we hear that from time to time. And so I want to reassure folks that the safety of the vaccine is good. And so those are probably the major pieces of why people don't get vaccinated, or it's just not convenient. I'm not interested. So we encourage people to, if you have a question about it, you know, call us, call your doctor. There's plenty of information online, but I caution folks to make sure that they use a good source when they get their information online. And our website, our Facebook page, have lots of really good information to point them to credible sources.
And some people, I think, are a bit concerned by the new messenger RNA vaccine type. Do you care to
not
talk?
New. Not new.
Okay, all right, so let's talk about that.
Not new.
So this is not the first time mRNA has been used for vaccine purposes.
The Ebola vaccine is an mRNA vaccine, and that vaccine's more than 10 years old. So the technology's there. This is not new technology. This is good technology. This is technology that clearly works both in Ebola as well as the COVID-19 vaccine. So it's good technology. Not all the vaccines are mRNA.
Correct.
You know, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is not an mRNA vaccine.
So Moderna and Pfizer are mRNA. Johnson & Johnson is, I would call it the old-fashioned, but maybe I'm wrong in saying, maybe they're all old-fashioned now. But there are some who would say that the mRNA is going to change your body's DNA.
No. What I think is important is that everyone has their own ideas of what they think is good for them and their family when it comes to medical care. What I encourage everybody, and not just on COVID-19 vaccine or any other vaccines, because I think it's important that you get good information and you're making a decision based on good, sound information, not what you saw on YouTube, not what your neighbor had said, not what your sister thinks. Okay, I want to make sure people have good information, and we're here to provide that information. You know, I took the vaccine. My family's take the vaccine. As soon as my children are eligible for the vaccine, they will get the vaccine. My parents got the vaccine. Our staff have gotten the vaccine. And so if this was really that bad or that dangerous, we wouldn't see the uptake among the people that are closest to the vaccine. And so I think I encourage people, as in all their medical care, seek a professional, talk to your doctor, or so call us. We'll point
speak
you
to the, so if you are unvaccinated and are unvaccinated because you are a bit concerned about the effects or what it means for you or your family, talk to your physician or call the Columbiana County General Health District, right?
Correct. Definitely use a credible source. That's very important.
And once again, well, so how do they contact you? Let's start with a phone number.
Yeah.
And then we'll give you a full contact at the end. But how do they just call you and say, I want to know more about the vaccine?
Sure. Our office number is 330-424-0272.
424-0272.
That's right. And they can also find us on online. Our website is columbiana-health.org. And we're also on Facebook.
And is that the same way that they would get more information about where and when they can get the vaccine?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Or they could call any of the partners our health partners around the county. So nearly every pharmacy in the county, both hospitals, all three health departments. We're actually seeing a lot of our physicians' offices now are starting to sign up to be carriers for the vaccine as well. And, you know, we're hopeful before the end of summer. You know, currently the vaccine's eligible for children 12 and over, the Pfizer vaccine. And so we're hopeful by the end of summer that we'll see that vaccine become available to children younger, as young as 6 months old.
And again, just one last statement on the safety and the review of these vaccines. The United States has, I think, the world's highest standard in reviewing vaccines. And am I correct in saying the AstraZeneca, which is approved in other countries, has not been approved in the United States?
As of today, that is correct, yes.
So not saying that won't happen eventually, but it goes to show that the United States takes vaccine safety very seriously.
Yes, and I think that's also represented in the recent pause with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It was, you know, very prudent. There was some things that needed followed up on and investigated, so they paused, followed up on, investigated, and found that the vaccine was still deemed safe. And so they lifted the pause, and we went back to using the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So it shows you that the system works, that review will happen if it's necessary. But at this point, we're seeing very, very good results and very effective vaccine against the spread of this virus.
Good. So we've been through what we hope is the worst part of the pandemic. We are trying to get to the end of the end, and everybody can help us get there by getting the vaccine. So just like every other, each one of these health issues that we talked about that brought public health to where it is today, we are probably about to a stage where we assess what happened, where we are, and what we ought to be thinking of for the future. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we're going in the right direction. I mean, there's still some work to be done. You know, certainly there's the need to get people, additional people vaccinated. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done as we continue through the pandemic. We still have positives, obviously, that we have to deal with, though the numbers are fewer and fewer. But it really helps to have the vaccine that's so effective. It really reduces the number of positives that we have to address, which then further prevents the spread of the virus. But I think going forward, Tad, I think we need to recognize that public health will go back to some of what we've done before, but we still have to continue our vigilance on communicable diseases, all communicable diseases, such as measles and flu and COVID-19. But we're back operational to provide full gamut of service. Our clinics are open. We're doing cancer clinic screenings today at our office with cancer clinic levy that's funded by the taxpayers of Columbiana County. So we're very pleased to be able to do that again and bring those patients back in. But I think as we go forward, you know, when we look to the fall, you know, hopefully the virus will subside. But we continue to stay in partnership with our schools and our school nurses. We're working currently with them on their plans, kind of a modified version of their COVID response plans. We're working on those right now. They're due to the state later in June. And we're going to continue to educate the schools, along with the school nurses, which have been great partners for us. You know, they did a lot of the disease tracking and a lot of the follow-up and education in the schools, and we provide them with a lot of that backup and that support. So we want to thank the schools and the school nurses for their great work. And we look forward to supporting them into the fall, along with our businesses, and trying to keep our community, both health, or all three, health, education, and economy, all stable as we go forward. So.
And the schools, they work through the ESC. You've coordinated through them, I imagine.
Yes, the ESC has been fantastic. They've been the hub that we've worked through the schools, kind of a clearinghouse. They organize a lot of the meetings and disseminate the information. The ESC has been a great partner and absolutely the conduit to the schools in our county as a whole. And so we appreciate all the partnership from Anna Marie Vaughn and her staff.
So business is getting back to usual for you, doing all the usual stuff in addition to all the things that you're doing to push this over the finish line and things that you've learned. Let me ask, just to kind of begin to wrap up, are you still too close to it to take an assessment of both your response and the even national or global response to this to start to say what was done well, what was not done well, what needs to be done in the future?
Well, we've segmented along the way. We've done different after action reports based on smaller pieces to our response. So, for example, the mass vaccination clinics at the fairgrounds. So we did a little after action and looked specifically at that. We've actually got a meeting next week with all of our staff where we're going to do a full after action report to date as to all of the pieces, the enforcement piece, the disease tracking piece, the vaccination piece, you know, our public information, our communications piece. Were we effective in all of those things? What do we do right? What do we need to improve on? So I think locally we're much closer to a short-term look back, but I think it will probably take a very long time to do a full comprehensive analysis of the whole public health system at the national level, the worldwide response, the national response, the state response. I think the local response will be easier for us to assess because we can get our arms around that. But I think we're going to have to wait some time to be able to look at the and it may be years before we really look at the impact. But we know what we've learned locally, and we know really where our strengths and our value is. And I can't say it enough, Tad, it's really in our partnerships and our people.
Well, thank you, Wes. Does sound like it was a challenging year and a half for Columbiana County, as it was the rest of the world, but we appreciate your work. We appreciate you being here today. We also would like to thank, if I could, there's been another person in the room that we haven't mentioned, but she came with Wes. Laura Faust, also of the General Health District, has been here, I think, as a fact checker for Mr. Vins, watching over his shoulder, but she didn't have to intervene very often, so I guess he did a pretty good job. But Laura, thank you, one, for coordinating this and for being here at least as moral support. So thank you. And thank you, Wes, again, for everything.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure, Tad. It's it's amazing to see what a community can do, a small community can do when we all work together. And certainly I want to recognize not just our partners, but all of our staff, including Laura, who did a fantastic job on communications, all of our staff and how hard they worked, and the partnership we had with the residents of Columbiana County, because that's really why we do what we do, all of us in public service, is to try to provide good service to our community and make it a great place to live and work.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody who is out there listening to today's podcast. We do hope that you'll check back with us often as we interview other people busy making Columbiana County an even better place in which to live and work. Also, we'd like to thank everybody out there who has rated and commented on the show. We are always pleasantly surprised by the positive ratings and reviews that we get out there. So hopefully you keep them coming. And that helps us obviously get recognized out there in among other people who are listening to podcasts. But we are also open to suggestions regarding guests and segments. And if you have any suggestions, please reach us at podcast@columbiana.org. Again, that's podcast@columbiana.org. Thank you.
Listening to Conversations with Columbiana County.